This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
It was a place of friends and of wonders and of miracles. It was a place where the Book of Mormon began to be translated, where Joseph and Emma first met, where they had their first home, and also the place where their first child was born and died. It was Harmony, Pennsylvania.
Donald L. Enders.
Significantly to the world, to all of us, was a great work that Joseph would help to bring to pass while living in this humble little dwelling.
Coming up next on the Joseph Smith Papers.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
Thanks for joining us. In our last show, we discussed the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and the miracle of its translation. Now, today, our intention is not so much to look at a single historical event in the prophet's life, but a series of events connected to a beautiful place, Harmony, Pennsylvania, which today is known as Oakland. Now, it's here in Harmony that Joseph first met the lovely and intelligent schoolteacher, Emma Hale. It's also here that Oliver Cowdery came down and the translation of the Book of Mormon went forward. Now, as to what it was that first brought Joseph to Harmony, Pennsylvania, Professor Richard Bushman describes.
The reason Joseph Smith is brought down here by Josiah Stoll, a long ways from his house in Palmyra, is not just because he was a good worker, but because, as Lucy Mack said, he had a key, which was the seer stone by which he could observe things. I think Joseph Smith was always reluctant treasure seeker. He was pressed into it. His family's in need. And he wants to go along with his father, who's a little more enthusiastic than he is.
Yes, for a time, Joseph Smith worked with others digging for a lost Spanish silver mine, something for which he was paid very little and slandered quite a bit. Finally, in 1838, Joseph responded to the charges of his having been a money digger. Dr. Alex Baugh tells us about it.
Question 10. Was not Joe Smith a money digger? Answer, yes. But it was never a very profitable job to him, and he only got $14 a month for it.
In his early 20s, while trying to earn a living, Joseph worked down on the New York and Pennsylvania border. It was there that he met Emma, and he boarded with her family for a time. It was also there that he met the Knight family. They became lifelong friends of the prophet Joseph, and they also, at one time, became benefactors to the work of translation.
William G. Hartley.
When Joseph came to work for the Knights, he, of course, was interested in Emma, and that's why he stayed in the area. And Joseph Knight, Jr. says that when he learned that he could trust the Knights, especially Father Knight and Joseph, Jr., he talked about Moroni. In fact, Joseph and Oliver came up here and said they had need, and on several occasions, Father Knight and his family provide materials for Joseph Smith, including at one point about 15 barrels of food and paper to help with the translating. And both Father Knight and his record and Joseph Smith and his record indicate that that was, in a way, a godsend to make the Book of Mormon happen faster than it would have happened otherwise.
No Spanish treasure was ever found, but that's not to say that Joseph didn't find something in Harmony of great value and interest.
Larry C. Porter.
The only silver or gold that came out of them Dar Hills was Emma, the comely daughter of Isaac Hale. Joseph Smith was attracted to her, and vice versa. She was spoken of as being a handsome woman. Polished or a finished individual, at least, had been away to boarding school and had been taught to be a school teacher.
Mark L. Staker.
Joseph first met Emma Hale while he was down in Harmony working. Her father owned a large amount of land, almost 100 acres, and her older brother, Jesse Hale, had just moved off of the property where he had a home. And Joseph Smith was brought in to stay at that home with some other individuals. And when he met Emma Smith, he was immediately struck by her. And he continued to court her for some time. And even after he left, he was only in Harmony for a few weeks. But as he came back, he moved about an hour away driving by sleigh. But as he came back regularly over a period of time, Joseph eventually decided that that Emma was somebody that he wanted to marry. As he went home and he talked to his parents, he told them he wanted to marry Emma and got their permission.
Emma was a woman of unusual education and ability. When Joseph met her, he said to his parents, "She would be my choice in preference to any other woman I have ever seen."
Emma was fairly tall, as was Joseph, 5'9", brown eyes, although her sisters had blue eyes, dark hair. Everybody was struck by her. There are a lot of accounts of her being very attractive. Other people were also interested in her. And so, you know, it's not surprising that Joseph was drawn to her. He went to his parents and asked them for permission to marry. Not everybody at this time period actually sought permission to marry, but Joseph was more conservative, more respectful, and that was one of the things that he did. Now, this document actually sheds a little more light on how that process all took place. And you need to understand that it was customary at that time for individuals to get married in the wife's home. And so Joseph naturally expected that he would go down and he would get married in their home. And you see here all this strikeout part in the document. Now, if you look carefully at what that says, it adds a little more insight into the whole marriage and the development of the marriage. And Joseph said, "Owing to my still continuing to assert that I had seen a vision, persecution still followed me. And so much was my wife's father excited that he was greatly opposed to our being married, insomuch that he did not suffer us to be married at his house. I was therefore under the necessity of taking her elsewhere." So what this says essentially right here is that, well, he said, "Not in my house are you getting married." Okay. And so Joseph takes that to mean, well, I can get married to her somewhere else then. And obviously, Isaac Hale in his affidavit later says, well, I told him that he couldn't marry her. Joseph took it a little further the context of this seems to have said, well, he didn't say I couldn't marry her. He said, "Not in my house are you going to get married." And so I went and married her somewhere else. And so this document then adds a little more insight into what that experience was like.
That somewhere else that Joseph spoke of was the house of Squire Tarbell, just up the Susquehanna River from Harmony.
Emma says that she hadn't really planned on marrying Joseph even after this took place. She goes up to visit Josiah Stoll, and apparently she probably went up to visit her sister, Elizabeth Wasson, who lives on the same turnpike where Josiah Stoll lives, just down a little bit further. And Emma goes up January 18th. Emma goes up to visit Josiah Stoll as part of this trip, and she says that Joseph importuned me, meaning that he begged again and again for me to marry him, and he does, and they end up getting married.
Isaac Hale, however, looked upon the happy occasion of Joseph and Emma's marriage just a little differently.
Young Smith made several visits at my house, and at length asked my consent to his marrying my daughter, Emma. This I refused and gave him my reasons for so doing, some of which were that he was a stranger and followed a practice that I could not approve of. He then left the place. Not long after this, he returned, and while I was absent from home, he carried off my daughter into the state of New York, where they were married without my approbation or consent.
The practice that Isaac Hale disapproved of was that Joseph had been a money digger. Now, there are some who have charged that Joseph Smith stole his wife. Well, with that in mind, Gordon Madsen searched out the law for that time.
There was no wife stealing in the case of Emma Smith. A woman was of legal age at 18 and needed no consent from her father or anybody else about getting married. So when she married Joseph at age 22, Isaac had no say in the matter. Period. Paragraph.
Many years later, just before she died, Emma shared the following with her son, Joseph Smith III, in a private interview in 1879.
I was married at South Bainbridge, New York, at the house of Squire Tarbell by him when I was in my 22nd or 23rd year. And it was the 22nd. I was visiting at Mr. Stoll's, who lived in Bainbridge, and I saw your father there. I had no intention of marrying him when I left home, but during my visit at Mr. Stoll's, your father visited me there. My folks were bitterly opposed to him, and being importuned by your father, and aided by Mr. Stoll, who urged me to marry him, and preferring to marry him to any other man I knew, I consented. We went to Squire Tarbell's and were married.
Now, Emma knew of Joseph's visions and revelations. He had told her, and she believed and she accepted those things. Hence, her commitment to marry Joseph was accepting more than just Joseph. When she accepted him, she accepted his cause as well, as Dr. Mark Staker explains.
One of the things that impresses me about this whole marriage is that Emma Smith is the first person to actually have to make a serious commitment as a Latter-day Saint. As we look at this document carefully, Joseph implies here that the family was upset about him continuing to assert that he had a vision.
Yeah.
Emma believes that he's had a vision, but she is the first one that leaves father and mother and brother and sister. Emma leaves everything behind but the clothes on her back to join Joseph Smith. And that's the first major commitment that anybody has to make in the Restoration, to really put their faith on the line and say, I believe. And Emma's the one that makes that commitment.
Since Joseph and Emma felt unwelcome staying in Harmony, they needed a place to live. So, with the help of Joseph Knight, they moved up to Manchester, New York, and lived with Joseph's family.
Now, the weather at this time ends up playing a role in all of this because it's extremely cold and a lot of snow, so traveling is really difficult. Joseph and Emma get married, and then Josiah Stoll takes them up north to Joseph's house. And immediately after they get married, it snows really heavily in the valley where Emma grows up. And Isaac Hale wasn't able to follow Emma up north and bring her back home.
And so couldn't pursue.
The angry father couldn't pursue, and the weather actually helped stop that. And so that they ended up married. And by the time they get, you know, relationships worked out, things are better.
In August, before he had gone to the hill in 1827, Emma had written to her father and said, is my dowry still mine? Is my milch cow still mine? And he wrote back, of course, daughter, and that it was available. Joseph, who never has a conveyance of his own, got his friend Peter Ingersoll, apparently paid him, to take he and Emma down here on the Susquehanna. And as they pulled into the Isaac Hale yard, Isaac Hale came out with a tear streaming down his face and saying, you stole my daughter. And it was a difficult season. Before they left, however, Isaac Hale was saying, come down and spend time with us.
Joseph and Emma were married in January of 1827. Then, at Isaac's invitation, in August of that same year, they came down for a visit. Joseph gets the place about a month later, September of 1827. And no sooner did he get them than his enemies went after him. There was no way for Joseph to translate. Therefore, when Isaac invited them to come down and live with them, the invitation was welcome. In December of 1827, they moved to Harmony.
Alva Hale, Emma's older brother goes up to bring Joseph and Emma down mm-hmm. to Harmony.
Right.
They hide the plates in a barrel of beans, seal them closed. They stop at taverns on the way down, which is where you sleep at night. And Joseph and Emma sleep in the tavern. Alva stays outside watching the plates to make sure that they're okay. Now, this is a person that doesn't believe that Joseph's a prophet, and yet he's out protecting those plates. And when he gets back to Harmony, one of the cousins says, well, didn't you look in there? And he said, no, because he said that if I looked at the plates, I would die. So I didn't look. And he said, and the cousin says, well, that wouldn't have stopped me. I would have gone and looked at it. You couldn't keep me from looking to see if they're there. But Alva seems to at least believe somewhat of Joseph's account, because he's willing to protect those plates and watch after them. And he's apparently the one that shares with his father that Joseph brought the plates down. Isaac Hale seems to first learn after Joseph comes down that he actually has a record. He didn't know about that before. And he wants to see the record. And Joseph says he can't see it. You know, the Lord's told him he can't show it to him. And that's when the rift seems to happen, that Isaac says, well, if you have anything like that in my house and you won't let me see it, you're out of here.
Since Isaac wouldn't allow Joseph and Emma to live with him with the plates, other arrangements had to be made, which turned out probably all for the better.
Joseph and Emma settle in Jesse and Mary McCune Hale's home, which is this middle structure right here. The other two homes have been added later on in this photograph taken by George Edward Anderson. And a very small home, not a lot of room in there to accomplish a lot of things. One account suggests that they hung a quilt up over the door to keep Emma's brothers from yelling rude things in the house while they're working on the translation process.
Okay.
But so they were very exposed to the community as they were working on this.
Just for a matter of perspective, it's in this home where so many of the foundational revelations of the Restoration were received. For example, one most notable was Section 4 of the Doctrine and Covenants. It came here, when Father Smith came down to pay his son a visit.
Donald L. Enders.
Significantly to the world, to all of us, was a great work that Joseph would help to bring to pass while living in this humble little dwelling. Not only a major part of the restoration of the Book of Mormon, as you know, but as well the restorations of priesthood. And then this marvelous revelatory time concerning the coming forth of the Church of Jesus Christ. And those revelations which were received here and that work which was done make this a most sacred and significant place.
It's during this time that Martin Harris comes down and begins to act as scribe for the prophet Joseph. They translate 116 pages. Then you know the story. Martin leaves with the manuscript to go home and show his family. As he leaves, Emma is probably in labor. The next day, Emma delivers a baby boy who lives only a short time.
For some reason, that infant is born unable to breathe or breathe adequately and dies within an hour of birth. It may be that Emma Smith was already ill at that time. We're thinking probably cholera, but haven't been able to narrow it down yet. But the infant dies as a result of that. Emma, for the next 2 weeks, is severely ill. Joseph thinks that she may not make it. His mother says that Joseph is awake constantly. There's not an hour that goes by that he's not attending to Emma's needs. But within this context, other individuals continue to die as well, as I mentioned, to clear into August. People in that part of the valley are dying and end up in the cemetery. And so it appears that something significant is going on with the health of the community. Now, this is also an A1, the history of the church. It begins with the genealogy of President Joseph Smith, Jr., and as part of that genealogy, they put down the birth of their first child. Mm-hmm. They don't give him a name here, and they don't give him a name on the headstone. That name appears much later, and it wasn't customary to give a child a name at that time, and so we don't think that they actually named the child when he was born, but later on he's come to be known as Alvin Smith. But here in this document, if you look carefully at the birth of the first child, it says, June 15th, 1828, a son is born unto Joseph Smith, Jr., Harmony, Pennsylvania, died the same hour. Now, that seems to be a contradiction from one of the women who was there at the birth says that the child was stillborn.
Right, yeah.
They say, well, how can the child be stillborn? And here this document says died the same hour. Lucy Mack Smith later says that the child died after it was born as well. Well, it turns out that during that time period, the phrase stillborn was applied by medical professionals to refer to a child that was born and didn't cry after it was born, but could die shortly afterwards. And so essentially what this means in context is that the child was stillborn, but he was born alive and didn't cry, wasn't healthy, and died. What happened to that child to bring about that death?
Night and day, Joseph tends to Emma, who hovers on the brink of death, until he himself is completely worn out. All the while, his apprehension is heightened because Martin is supposed to come back with that manuscript, but Martin doesn't come back.
As you know, Martin's lost the manuscript. Joseph returns without it, and he needs to tell Emma that the materials are lost, that they had both worked so hard on. And that's one of the things that seems to be of great concern to him when he first finds out he's lost the pages. The thing that he worries about most is having to tell Emma that they're lost. He's afraid that it'll put her in the grave because she's already so ill. He returns, and she seems to recover fairly rapidly from her illness. And Joseph says that they continue to work on the manuscript. Emma says that they work day after day, and she writes for him hour after hour.
Joseph returned to Harmony without the manuscript, and he spent the rest of the summer of 1828 in deep repentance and in mighty prayer before the Lord. Then, September 22nd, 1828, Moroni gave him back the Urim and Thummim and the plates. And for the rest of that winter, Joseph and Emma worked slowly on the translation.
Typically, we don't think of Emma as having played a big role in producing the Book of Mormon manuscript, but it seems that she was actually involved in the process in a much bigger way than we imagine. She corrects Joseph on how to pronounce names, for example. He asks her if there are really walls around the city of Jerusalem, details that he's not familiar with. Emma, as the well-schooled individual, you know, coming with education that Joseph Smith doesn't have, she, to some extent, plays a tutorial role for him. She's his tutor in helping him understand things that he... you know, the basic pronunciation of names so that he can produce this document. And she plays an important role in doing this. Emma is very close to the translation of the Book of Mormon. When Joseph works out initially the characters that are on the plates for Martin Harris to take with him, Emma is intimately involved in that, helping to produce that. She does say that at one point in time, the plates are sitting on the table, wrapped in the tablecloth, and she thumbs the pages of the plates, and she hears a metallic rustle. She feels them, feels the metallic plates in there, but she doesn't actually look at the plates because she's been asked not to. So it shows a remarkable reserve on her part that she has this record right in front of her because she's asked not to look at it. She doesn't, but she does feel it. She moves it around on the table as she dusts, and she's very close to the record.
In that same 1879 interview, near the end of her life, Emma shared the following eyewitness observation of Joseph and the translation of the Book of Mormon.
My belief is that the Book of Mormon is of divine authenticity. I have not the slightest doubt of it. I am satisfied that no man could have dictated the writing of the manuscript unless he was inspired. For when I was acting as his scribe, your father would dictate to me hour after hour, and when returning after meals or after interruptions, he would at once begin where he had left off without either seeing the manuscript or having any portion of it read to him. This was the usual thing for him to do. It would have been impossible that a learned man can do this, and for one so ignorant and unlearned as he was, it was simply impossible.
In order for the work to go forward, Joseph needed a scribe. Well, that following April, Oliver Cowdery appeared on his doorstep along with Joseph's brother Samuel in Harmony, Pennsylvania. Oliver was an answer to Joseph's prayers.
And Joseph says here that on the fifth day of April, 1829, Oliver Cowdery came to my house. Until then, I'd never seen him. Oliver Cowdery just shows up with one of Joseph's brothers. And it was raining the whole way down there, very bad weather. And journal accounts from that area of Pennsylvania suggest that there was still a lot of snow on the ground. It's still very cold. And we tend to think of April as being springtime, but it's a little late when Oliver arrives. The very next day, April 6th of 1829, the ice breaks on the river. And over the next 2 weeks, boating industry records suggest that over 3,000 boatmen went past Joseph Smith's back door while he and Oliver Cowdery begin the translation of the Book of Mormon together. And we tend to think of them as in a quiet valley all by themselves, when there are hundreds of men every day going right by their house just outside, and you can imagine them hollering at each other and moving down the river and all this activity. And they're really on one of the major highways of America at the time, right by the, you can imagine living right by a highway while you're trying to begin a translation of the Book of Mormon.
Joseph and Oliver continued to translate until finally the persecution became so intense they had to move. Now, you may find it interesting. The source of most of that persecution, it was Emma's uncle.
The latter part of May, they have reached a point where Nathaniel Lewis, the local Methodist preacher, is creating problems. Mother Smith said they feared for their lives, or Joseph feared for his life. And there was their message to the Whitmers. Down comes David. David Whitmer takes them back. And the translation of the Book of Mormon is completed at the Whitmer farm.
Joseph and Emma moved to Fayette in June of 1829. Sometime after the organization of the church in April of 1830, they go back down, but only for a short time. By the end of August 1830, Joseph and Emma left Harmony, Pennsylvania, and they never returned.
When we come back, the restoration of the priesthood. We will discuss the who, the how, and especially the when next week on the Joseph Smith Papers.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.